Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 94, Dream Wisdom, May 25th, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
So there's a sense of working through and reassurance, and you can see these stages, the stages of grief or the stages of coping with becoming a parent through the dreams, and it really helps people feel a hope and a reassurance when they're going through a stressful event. By using the dreams, you can get a map of where you are and a kind of reassurance that things are evolving and changing. Or you see the block and you know what you have to work on to work through what you're not dealing with.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Alan Siegel. Alan Siegel, Ph.D., is an adult and child psychologist with over 30 years of teaching and publishing on dream-related topics. He's the author of Dream Wisdom, Uncovering Life's Answers in Your Dreams. Dr. Siegel is a former president of the International Association for the Study of Dreams and editor emeritus of the IASD magazine, Dreamtime. He stars in and is featured as a regular commentator on the new Discovery Health Channel program, Dream Decoders. His commentaries on post-911 nightmares, children's dreams, and dream interpretation have been featured on NBC's Today Show, as well as CNN News, PBS, NPR, the Discovery Channel's The Power of Dreams series, and NBC's primetime special, The Secret World of Dreams. Dr. Siegel is a licensed psychologist practicing psychotherapy and psychological assessment of children and adults in Berkeley and San Francisco. He's assistant clinical professor at the University of California, Berkeley, Department of Psychology. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Alan Siegel, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you know, I think I recall that you were a student at Sonoma State University at one time. Is that where your interest in dreams began?
Well, it began before that, but that certainly helped me develop my interest more because I was able to really focus on dreams and use those both for professional development and training, but also for personal development. But I really started getting interested when I took my first course in psychology in college, and found that Freud and Jung came up with a lot of their theories by keeping their own dream journals and learning from interpreting and working with and exploring their own dreams.
Right. And then were you at Sonoma then for a master's program, or did you finish?
Yeah, I was there for a master's in about 1975, so it dates me back a little bit.
Okay. And where did you go from there?
I got my PhD at the California School of Professional Psychology and have been practicing as a psychologist for 25 years, doing both therapy and assessment, writing. I've got my book, Dream Wisdom, which also has a website, dreamwisdom.info, and have done research as well on dreams, particularly on post-traumatic nightmares, on expected father's dreams, and on children's dreams. Those have been some of my research areas, in addition to my clinical work and teaching on dreams.
Okay, great. Well, I will definitely want to make sure that we check into each of those research areas. But I thought initially we'd focus on your book, Dream Wisdom, Uncovering Life's Answers in Your Dreams. Now, how did you come to write that book?
Well, in part, it was inspired from my early undergraduate days when I began writing my dreams down. I noticed that there was a pattern in my dreams, or numerous patterns, but particularly when I would go through stressful or traumatic kinds of times in my life, I'd have certain characteristic dreams.
Uh-huh.
For example, a snake or a serpent, threatened by that, would come out. One time I was mugged going to a concert when I was in undergraduate school. Other times, like when my grandfather died, I would have these snake dreams and certain other dreams. Like, even from my own dreams, I saw that crises appeared to generate a characteristic set of dreams, which were very helpful in guiding me.
Now, would these crises then trigger the snake dreams? Because I've had lots of snake dreams myself. That's a set of dreams that have been very interesting to me in my own life. Did those crises in your life trigger the snake dreams? I'm interested in the snake dreams because I've had quite a few of those myself.
Yes, they did, which isn't to say that snake dreams are only crisis-related, but for me, they had deep roots because the very first dream I remembered, circa age 4, was a dream of being threatened by a snake. And so it was a dream that I'd had even in childhood that would recur at later times. So all over the world, people interpret snake dreams in different ways. For me, one of the dimensions of the meaning of the snake dream was that a sense of mortal threat, which was more related to emotional threat.
Yes.
When I would feel something was throwing me off balance, upsetting me, the snakes would appear as a symbol of kind of, anxiety or feel of it, or insecurity.
Right. I can really relate to that. In my own version of snake dreams, often it's been a situation where I was surrounded by snakes and I was paralyzed by fear. I felt I couldn't move or they would get me. I couldn't jump over them. And so certainly at a metaphorical level, that seems to me to talk about maybe being stuck somewhere or emotionally fearful, something like that.
Yeah. Often people remember just one or two dreams from childhood, even though you may have 15,000 or 20,000 dreams in childhood. And that was one of, three or four dreams I remembered. And what was interesting is in the dream, I had a reaction similar to yours, a sense of terror, mortal threat. But I tried to negotiate with the snake to get it not to bite me.
Oh, good for you.
And, you can interpret that in many different ways. I mean, it sort of shows that there was a bit of a problem solving. I was trying to cope.
Yeah.
And you see this a lot in trauma survivors, that when there's no effort to cope, when the adversary, whether it be the snake or the terrorist in the dream, overwhelms you and you don't even have a way to fight back, you're probably more stuck and overwhelmed. But when you can see efforts to fight back, there's probably some stress that you're having some success or at least some ability to begin to cope with. I find it interesting in terms of, becoming a psychologist later in life, too, because you sort of work with people verbally to help them work out of crisis situations and to figure things out. So I think it was both a personal overcoming a challenge or showing those efforts, but also words were something that I used even at that age or thought I could use to help myself or help other people. And in psychology, that's a lot of what we do.
Yeah.
With dreams or with general therapy techniques.
Fascinating. Now, we're talking about snake dreams, which I guess are pretty common. In your book, you talk about 20 universal dreams, and I don't know if snake dreams are among the 20 universal. Give us some examples of what you mean by universal dreams.
Well, first of all, dream symbols are often interpreted specific to a culture. So if someone is dressed in white, in one culture, that may represent birth, and in another culture, that may represent death. So you have to know about a person's cultural beliefs. In therapy, you actually have to ask them, how would your family interpret this, or what would your version of the symbol be, particularly if you're working with someone who's of a culturally different background.
Yes.
But on to the universal dreams, there appear to be, apart from the cultural trappings that may differ, certain themes like falling, flying, mm-hmm. appearing naked in public, being back in high school or college and being unprepared for an exam, losing your wallet, missing the bus or the plane, getting chased or attacked,
How about losing your teeth? Is that
okay,
one?
Okay, that was the next one I was going to get to. I was going to use that as a special example.
Okay, good.
So that's an example. If I give a lecture for a large public group, you know, say if there's 100 people there and I'm giving a lecture, and if you say, raise your hand if you've had a flying dream, you know, 90 to 95%
yes.
will have had a flying dream or a paralysis dream or a falling dream. Those are really universal themes. But if you say, who here has had a teeth falling out dream, you know, half the people will look quizzical, I've never heard of that, and the other half will say, oh yeah. And typically, the teeth falling out dream comes out in the form, not always, but very frequently, where the teeth crumble and fall out. I don't know whether that's, you know, how you've heard it, but the people say, well, should I go to the dentist? Am I having a dental problem? Well, that gets into the issue of the objective and subjective meaning of dreams.
Yes.
It may mean you have a dental problem, but more often, dream symbols are metaphors for emotional states of mind and inner conflicts and things like that. So typically, teeth symbolize power, potency, the ability to eat, to cut, and losing your teeth has to do with some sense of powerlessness or impotence. It more often people have this dream when they're either experiencing a physical challenge, like the diagnosis of cancer or being on crutches due to a leg injury, or an emotional blow to one's self-esteem, getting fired, getting rejected by a friend, feeling left out in some way. And the losing your teeth is that loss of power, mm-hmm. that loss of emotional power and potency.
Kind of now, losing your bite.
Yeah, lose your bite. Now, I want to use this as an example of how you don't want to rely on me telling you what a teeth dream or a flying dream means, but you have to use your own life experience and memories and your own imagination to make sure that the interpretation is in the right direction. And so the teeth falling out dream might certainly be different if you were a dentist or if you just had a root canal.
Right.
It could maybe more have to do with that. And I had one example in Dream Wisdom that I talk about is a woman who had a dream where she was losing her teeth. Now, if I jumped in and said, oh, powerlessness, I know what that means,
mm-hmm.
I would have missed the twist that the dream took.
Yes.
She was a woman who was considering going back to grad school and going to work. Her kids had reached elementary age, and she wanted to get back and do something on her own. And she was deciding whether to go back to grad school and to go back to work. And after she lost her teeth in the dream, she looked inside her mouth and felt, and there was a new set of teeth coming up. So it was a fear of loss of power, like I'm not good enough to work or go back to school. But the dream was actually reassuring her, you do have the power. You got a new set of teeth coming in. You've got a power that you haven't even known about that's emerging.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in a sense, ultimately, the twist in the dream, if you look at the whole image, not just the symbol of teeth falling out, says this is the renewal of power dream, a fear of loss of power, but a renewal of power. So the opposite of what you would have found if you looked it up in a dream dictionary and said, teeth falling out means loss of power.
Right, right. Well, given that dreams are so personal and specific, mostly need to be interpreted and understood in the context of the person's life, why do you think there are universal dreams? Do you have any ideas about, you know, why there should be a class of dreams that tend to be universal?
Well, I mean, I somewhat like it in a general way, Jung's idea of the archetypes or sort of how he came up with that, which is that there are certain universal human experiences which we cope with in waking life, which then get reflected into very common dreams. And so, for example, dreams of being chased or threatened. Now, those dreams don't always have to do with walking through a neighborhood that's high crime, although they might. but they often have to do with emotional threats. And so, you know, as a child, you may hear certain things, and that fear then goes into your dreams and might represent some insecurity about being fired from a job or being rejected by a friend. So general insecurity as an adult may configure back into a fear of being chased or hurt that might date back to a childhood fear. So kind of our childhood fears and traumatic events in life are similar. Loss of power, rejection, abandonment, these are the fears and the wounds that humans are vulnerable to. And some of these seem to be common universal experiences that can configure in certain ways in dreams.
Yeah, in other words, we, as human beings, we share certain existential realities and commonalities.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely say that's true. But it's different cultures would interpret the dreams differently.
Yes.
Jung's idea was that there were certain archetypes, like a shadow or the great mother, and the dreams, depending on the culture, it may take different clothing, the theme, but the underlying structure of the theme would have been shaped through evolution of common experiences. Let's say being dependent when you're born and cared for by a mother would shape our psyche so powerfully that we would have dreams about being cared for or rejected or nurtured or taken care of would come out in abandonment dreams or threat dreams, you know, even as an adult. But it's shaped by your personal experience of being cared for by a mother and over evolution, human experience of going through that first few years of dependency on parents.
Wow, you've just given me an idea for a research hypothesis that I don't know if anybody's done, but you know how there's been this big swing in general, you know, in terms of the nature-nurture controversy and how much is learned and how much we're born with. And
yes.
And we sort of come out of a period where everything was pretty much on the nurture side, that everything was based on learning, you know, due to the influence of the behaviorists and so on. And then in more recent years, the pendulum has swung back to where we now understand that so much more about our personalities are given to us genetically than we ever believed. You know, that comes from twin studies and so on. So it's making me wonder about the possibility of doing genetic research to see if certain dream themes or motifs or some quality of the dreams is shared, you know, say between mother and child.
There, I've seen, actually, it's an interesting research topic, and I've seen a little bit of literature, not an overwhelming, convincing body of literature, but some things that suggest that your idea has, you know, some real importance to it. One is Jung. In some of his writings, when his adult patients couldn't remember their dreams and work on them in therapy,
yeah,
he told them to tell their children's dreams. Because essentially what he's saying is that some of the dreams that a family member would have would be representing some shared stress or crisis that other family members are having. It may have to also do with the parenting relationship, too, that he asked that. Another thing is, I have seen some tendency towards, in families with kids and adults, having somewhat similar themes in their dreams, even recurring nightmares that might be similar between parents and children that they've both had. There's been some, you know, depending on what you believe in terms of the validity of telepathic or precognitive dreams, whether you believe it or not, you see more examples amongst close family members of shared dreaming.
Yes.
And also, if precognitive dreams were to be proven to be valid or whatever, it would kind of make some sense in terms of evolution that a mother or close family members would have heightened intuition so as to protect their child or their close family members from harm or threat. I don't know if I'm going afield from
that's fine. Yeah, I think that the thing that intrigued me about that was that it might be a way to kind of test out Jung's idea that some of this is actually genetic memory, that these archetypes are in some way encoded in our genes. I think in some places he seems to imply that. And so I was thinking, well, gee, maybe there's a way to test that out, particularly if you were to test mothers and children with test children who were reared apart from their mothers so that you could rule out the nurture part of it. But let's move on. You mentioned Jung working with people who are having poor dream recall, and I know that's a topic you discuss in your book. What are the issues as far as you're concerned around dream recall?
Well, it's therapeutic and personally and creatively rewarding to remember your dreams. And usually what happens is we're in this culture, we're not encouraged to take dreams as valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And if you teach your children that dreams are valuable, they can give you insights, they can also give you great creative inspiration for drawing or stories or things, then people tend, when encouraged, they tend to remember dreams and share them and make them important in just conversations during the day. So you can be taught to improve dream recall, and the techniques are pretty simple. It's keeping a journal by the side of your bed, telling someone you trust, a spouse, family member, relative, friend, your dreams on some kind of regular basis, and they're in turn sharing them.
Okay.
If you spend a little bit of time quiet right when you wake up, and you give yourself a suggestion before you go to sleep that I will remember my dreams, it will tend to enhance recall. And if you keep a journal, even if irregularly, you begin to see patterns, which then inspires you to say, wow, this is really interesting. I'm really learning about myself and even getting creative ideas. And then that encourages dream recall. So it's somewhat that we're culturally, we don't emphasize dreams. And the more you make them important, see their creative and, you know, emotional value, then you start to remember them more.
Yes, and I found that if I'm reading a book on dreams, I tend to remember them more.
Yeah. Now, one point I wanted to take up on that I didn't completely finish about the thesis of Dream Wisdom, my book, which is that I later found that there were patterns in dreams when people were undergoing important life transitions, like getting married, having a child, experiencing grief or loss, that certain characteristic dreams would occur, like those universal dreams falling and flying in the general population. Expectant parents tend to dream about giving birth to furry mammals, especially women. And those furry mammals are usually symbols of the developing relationship with the fetus even before it's born. And there's a series of maybe 10 or 15 common dreams that expectant parents have. And there's certain common dreams that people undergoing divorce have. There's a whole set and a sequence of dreams that people undergoing grief or loss seem to have. All of these dreams tell us something about the inner changes we go through when we have a child or experience grief, but they also give you guideposts emotionally to help you navigate these stressful changes. So dreams can guide us and help us navigate through life passages and come out the other end in a more balanced kind of way.
Do they serve as signposts that tell us how far we have progressed in terms of dealing with the crisis that we're going through?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways a good example are grief dreams.
Okay.
And typically, shortly after someone dies, the dreams are very upsetting. There's a sense of loss. You can see the person, you know, with cancer, all haggard or whatever. But then as you gradually work through the grief, then you see a whole other set of dreams, like the person coming back and saying, I'm okay, don't worry about me. Maybe looking like an angel up in heaven, or maybe interacting with you in a way like you used to years ago when they were healthy. So there's a sense of working through and reassurance, and you can see these stages, the stages of grief or the stages of coping with becoming a parent through the dreams, and it really helps people feel a hope and a reassurance when they're going through a stressful event. By using the dreams, you can get a map of where you are and a kind of reassurance that things are evolving and changing. Or you see the block and you know what you have to work on to work through what you're not dealing with.
Boy, that certainly refutes the argument from some people who would maintain that dreams are an entirely random phenomenon.
Well, that gets back into the whole, you know, nature, nurture, or psychological versus physiological basis for personality. But I think that anybody who keeps a journal will see incredible connections between the content of their dreams and current and past life events.
Definitely.
And it's funny that there's a psychiatrist, Alan Hobson, who's often quoted as the kind of skeptic who,
right,
you know, to some extent says that dreams aren't that meaningful, that they're more shaped by physiological events in the brain. And he was on, there was a Discovery Show program called The Power of Dreams that I was in a couple of segments on. He was on, and while stating that he was attempting to refute that dreams were meaningful, they had him tell a dream that just seemed so dripping with meaning that he seemed to contradict his very own point. So I think that the most sophisticated ideas these days, even for the people that say that dreams are more, you know, physiologically based, like they're triggered by events in the brain while we sleep and dream, that even some of those folks take a model which blends that there's probably some psychological basis combined with maybe some physiological basis.
Interesting.
I think the meaning is more shaped by emotional challenges, things that threaten us or that we have that are new, that we have to cope with and overcome, changes in our identity, threats to our sense of security and stability. These are the things that our dreams help us with. And sometimes they help us by exaggerating the problems, unfortunately, and we get nightmares. But dreams really are on the cutting edge of what's most new and challenging and often difficult for us emotionally in our lives.
Yes. And
they take our temperature, give us a kind of x-ray,
yeah,
of our unconscious, which then allows us to identify issues that we need to, that we need help with or to work on.
Yeah, and then as therapy goes along or as time passes, these dreams come along that seem to suggest progress, just as you were suggesting in the case,
yeah,
of
you
grief.
Can sometimes even see this on a short, I mean, you can see this over the course of therapy or when someone's going through grief. What I teach at the graduate level, our dreams, clinical use of dreams, or a course called Understanding Your Dreams, and I have people keep a 2-week journal so they can interpret their own set of dreams within a 2-week period just as a sort of an exercise.
Yeah.
And sometimes people even see an evolution even within a short period of, let's say, coping with an issue that you were feeling challenged by, and they might see that issue evolve with even over a short period of time by looking carefully at a series of dreams.
Yes. And that really underscores the value of keeping a journal, because if you don't keep a journal, you don't tend to notice those patterns. The dreams, you just they just seem to stand alone. But when you can look back over a series, you can see patterns that you might have otherwise missed.
Right. And especially, and this is kind of the theme of dream wisdom, is when you undergo these huge epic life events, like divorce or marriage or having a child or, you know, a serious illness, the dreams seem to gravitate towards helping you by exaggerating or helping you work through those issues. And there's these themes, you know, the people who are divorcing dreams that they're alone or naked, like they've lost their roles or their identities. People who are about to be married, they often have what I call the Bride of Frankenstein dreams, where their fiancé appears in clothes in bad taste or behaves in ways that are sort of embarrassing. And so you're working through your fear. Am I marrying the right person?
Yes.
Am I going to be emotionally damaged by making this commitment? And it comes out in these funny, upsettingly funny kind of ways, like your fiance turning into something that would, you know, not be something you want to live with, someone you want to live with. And it's sort of exaggerating your worst fears as then a way of helping you work through it. I mean, a good example is one of the characteristic pregnancy dreams. Expectant parents dream that they're taking care of their baby, and then they somehow forget and go off and do something fun. And they say, oh my God, when I wake up, I'm going to be a terrible parent. I shouldn't be having a child. But in reality, that nightmare is a positive sign that they're internally preparing for the tremendous responsibility of parenting.
Interesting. Interesting. You know, as you were talking, I just realized that there's another kind of dream that I've had very occasionally, and I wonder if you've heard of this, which are funny dreams, which in which I've woken up laughing. My laughter woke me up. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah, I mean, less often than the scary dreams.
Yeah,
but I had a kind of joking phrase about that. In the 70s, people were interested in the primal scream, and that's kind of the primal giggle.
Yeah,
you know, so. Often, you know, it's something, I mean, you have to really look at what you're laughing at or what the situation was. If there's something, you know, finding amusement is somewhat unusual in a dream, but it may, you know, suggest that something is making you happy or something is, you know, tickling your funny bone in some way. It could be denial, like people laughing, you know, when they're upset. I mean, you really just have to look at what laughter means to you and look at whether, you know, there's something that you're finding either amusing or startling or, you know, the kinds of things that would provoke laughter.
Yeah.
How does that click with something going on in your life? And, you know, are you a person who laughs easily or not so easily? You know, things like that to help you come up with what the laughter might mean. But if it leaves you with a positive residue,
mm-hmm,
emotionally when you wake up, I mean, it's likely that you've resolved something, because unresolved dreams tend to leave you with an emotional negative residue. You feel kind of weighted down with a dark cloud over your head during the first part of the day or during the day after having an unresolved nightmare.
Well, I always felt good, I think, after that kind of laughter dream.
So, kind of suggests that something was either worked through in the dream, or it's symbolizing something is feeling positive or working through in your life.
Yeah, I like your expression of the primal giggle. I'm going to try to remember that.
Now, you've
mentioned nightmares, and so what's your take on nightmares?
Well, one idea that I like to pose, and I was touching on this with talking about the expectant parents' dreams of forgetting the baby and they should have been taking care of it.
Yes.
Is that moderate nightmares during a period of stress are probably a healthy sign rather than an unhealthy sign. And the metaphor that I like to use is that nightmares to a moderate level may be more like a vaccine than a poison.
Hmm.
A poison emotionally would be something that leaves you unresolved and then really goes into a dead end in terms of emotional resolution. But a vaccine helps to stimulate the antibodies so you don't get, you know, smallpox or whatever it is. And nightmares, the way that I was discussing the parenting dream of forgetting the baby, helps you prepare by making you anxious, then you want to, you know, develop ways to be a better parent. Go to the prenatal classes, get better prenatal care. So nightmares actually may help us by allowing us to work through both at night and then be left with important issues that we have to, you know, ponder and work through based on the nightmares. So they actually may be a positive sign.
There
was an amazing study back in the 70s, which some studies have replicated a little bit. Pregnant women during the middle of pregnancy who had more dreams with threat and hostility had shorter labors and fewer complications.
Interesting.
That seems counterintuitive or the opposite of what you'd expect, but it seems like those women who could tolerate thinking about the normal conflict of having a child, the anxieties, were more able to work it through and let go when it actually came time to give birth, and it had a physical correlate as well as an emotional correlate. So interesting stuff, and nightmares may help us. Now, that being said, extreme nightmares with graphic violence, death, destruction, high degree of lack of resolution with no attempt at coping, so, and if the content repeats and doesn't change, that's sort of a description of post-traumatic nightmares. Those dreams may, particularly when there's no signs of coping or overcoming the stress,
yes,
could well be a sign that you may need some mental health help or some support, that you're stuck, and that the immunization or the vaccine kind of thing has gone awry, and the nightmares are actually causing you problems unto themselves, and not necessarily, they've gone beyond the point of most dreams, which help you solve problems by pointing them out, to where the dream itself is rubbing salt on the wound, causing more of a problem than what it's helping. This would be more extreme, repetitive, unchanging nightmares with very graphic content and with little degree of fighting back or resolving.
As a therapist, then, how would you work with those?
Well, for people who suffered trauma, you know, after those who were near the 911, attacks, people who've been in car accidents or, had sexual abuse or physical violence inflicted upon them, they tend to have some of these repetitive, unchanging, graphically violent dreams. Often, very simple techniques, like just retelling the dream and imagining a different ending, or making a picture of the dream, or creating either a verbal dialogue, a la Gestalt therapy, or an internal dialogue, like writing out character lines like a play, will dramatically change the course of this dream. I mean, it may alter the nightmare drastically to the point where you may still have nightmares, but they begin to have outs of resolutions, of problem solving, and then the nightmare becomes less of the problem unto itself, and you can begin to access the underlying issues which are causing nightmares. So nightmares can be a symptom unto themselves, and it can be very effective to actually use creative self-expression, drawing, creating a new ending, using fantasy, to bring an upsetting, repetitive nightmare to some kind of fantasy conclusion. That seems to help people quite a bit.
Okay, that's very interesting. I attended a presentation at an earlier IASD conference. I'm blocking on his last name, and I've actually interviewed him here on the show. David, something, you may know his name, who speaks about nightmares in terms of Joseph Campbell's Journey of the Hero, that the nightmare can be the call to adventure, bringing something to our awareness that we're trying to avoid, but if we're willing to engage it, that this can open up a whole new journey for us.
I like that metaphor of both the hero's journey, but also the idea that the nightmare has something to teach us.
Yeah.
And that sometimes, the bad news is the nightmare is upsetting, but the good news is that sometimes the nightmares, by jarring our awareness and upsetting us a little bit, have more to teach us, and we have more to learn about what we're less aware of. So I like that idea.
Yeah, so in a sense, the nightmare can be a blessing if instead of running away from it, we engage with it somehow. If it's moderate,
right.
Yeah.
It's very much. I think that if we engage our nightmares, there may be great wisdom that we can extract from them. And that's the other The other thing is that we talked earlier about the value of keeping a journal and looking at a series of dreams. Sometimes you may have a nightmare that doesn't end with any kind of resolution, but you may have other nightmares or partial nightmares that have partial resolutions or ways of, you know, creative solutions can come in dreams as well. So you have to look at the nightmare and see whether there's any sense of resolution.
I think
and also on a more therapeutic note, in my book on children's dreams, dream catching, I have what I call the four R's of nightmare relief. It sounds almost like a aspirin commercial or something from the 60s. But the first step is reassurance. That if you don't feel emotionally reassured, be it a child or an adult, it's hard to even say the dream to anyone else. It feels like it's going to, you know, draw you into its web of pain. The next step is rescripting, which is giving the dream a different ending or expressing it in some creative form, which seems to take the sting out of the dream and allows you to begin to play with what the images may mean. And the next R is rehearsal, which is doing that in a few different ways, finding different kinds of resolution. And finally, resolution, which is connecting the symbols and the imagery of the dream to something upsetting in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And then taking some steps to fix that problem the awareness was stimulated by the dream.
Okay, well, I'm glad you called listeners' attention to that book about children's dreams, because listeners with children may well want to pick up a copy of that.
Yeah, and Dream Wisdom also has a bunch of information and a chapter and a bunch of references about children's dreams as well.
Okay, now you know, we've talked about journal keeping, and I'm intrigued by the fact that in your book, you refer to keeping a dream wisdom journal. Now, I've heard of keeping a dream journal, but I'm interested in your use of the word wisdom there. What is it that's implied by that?
Well, I think in general, there is an inner wisdom that's contained within our dreams. And, you know, I guess when you look for different spiritual pathways or whatever, or different religious approaches or psychological theories, there's something about dreams that is unique in that within the dream is a kind of unique personal exaggeration of our problems, but also access to solutions to different issues that we're having a hard time dealing with. So there's a kind of x-ray of our unconscious or inner wisdom that's accessible through dreams that sometimes is less accessible through conscious problem solving or thinking about something. Now, that wisdom seems to come to the surface even more when we're under great stress or are going through, you know, epic or important life passages, you know, like getting married or going through a midlife crisis, things like that. And in those cases, it seems that the wisdom, the inner wisdom, is more accessible, often through nightmares or upsetting dreams, but sometimes through vivid dreams that are very creative or even very positive dreams where you have great insights or ideas that seem to just come right out almost without interpretation through the dream.
Okay, I want maybe to ground all of this discussion that we've been having. I wonder if you could share a pivotal dream from your own life, how you worked with it, where it led you. Is there a dream that comes to mind that you'd feel comfortable sharing?
Well, I'm going to go back to a formative time, and it's actually when I was at Sonoma State, and I was, you know, about 23, 24 years old, around there.
Yeah.
And was having some self-doubts and looking at career options as to what I wanted to, did I want to be a psychologist or go in some other direction?
Mm-hmm.
And I did what's called a dream incubation, where this is a procedure, it's a kind of variation on the ancient Greek temples. In ancient Greece, there were hundreds of temples to the god Asclepios, the god of woundedness, and people would go to these temples to have a dream that would bring them either spiritual or physical healing. The modern form of this is what's called dream incubation, where you pose an important life issue or question to your dream and attempt to generate or incubate a dream that might give you deeper insight. And that's what I did, actually under the guidance of a Sonoma State professor, Gordon Tappan.
Yes.
Who you probably knew.
Definitely.
And I had a dream that I actually did this out in nature and was trying to have a dream, and I woke up and had this amazing dream, but then forgot it. And then was kind of upset because I thought that was going to be the answer to all my questions. And then once I kind of gave up thinking I wouldn't have a powerful dream or a dream that would guide me, I had a dream that I was in a redwood fairy ring, which is the set of redwood trees that grows up around a huge old growth tree that either gets cut down or burned down. And all of the trees turned into totem poles that stretched up to the sky. And it was just an amazing and inspiring dream. At the time, for me, it didn't say, you know, be a psychologist or don't be a psychologist.
Yeah.
It wasn't that specific. But it gave me a sense of my own inspiration and creativity. And it was also, I'm interested in Native American art, so it kind of incorporated that. And it left me with the positive and inspired feeling that helped me complete my master's thesis and, you know, get some other things done and eventually go more, you know, through a lot of other events. I'd go back and finish my PhD in psychology. But it was something that, at a crucial moment of questioning identity and career path, it really helped me see and be reassured by my creativity and sense of internal power at that time.
If that had been my dream, I think I would have experienced it as myself being surrounded by strong support and power, with all these mighty redwoods in a circle. Is that sort of how it touched you?
Yeah, that's somewhat how it was to me. But it's interesting what you said, too, is that a lot of people through in the International Association for the Study of Dreams use a technique developed by Montague Ullman where you, in a group, people share dreams.
Mm-hmm.
You preface your statements about a person's dream with, if this were my dream. I noticed you did that.
Sure.
And that's a great way to have a group reassociate to a dream, and each person in the group will almost get into the dream as if it was their dream, and then the person who had the dream can kind of pick and choose what they gain the most benefit from.
Yes.
You get a kind of collage or pastiche of all these possible levels of meaning, and then the person who had the dream can then pick and choose what is most meaningful to them.
Yes. Now, you're going to be presenting at this upcoming IASD conference in Rohnert Park. What are you presenting on?
Well, first of all, I chair the Continuing Ed Committee, so I put together a series of programs that are helping train therapists, and it's somewhat of a lost art. People aren't getting as much training in the mental health field as they used to on dreams. I'm trying to reverse that trend by providing and organizing an advanced training on clinical use of dreams. I'm going to be looking at teaching dreams to therapists, a course on dreams and clinical supervision, and also a course on ethics in dreams, looking at how to deal with post-traumatic nightmares and really upsetting dreams and proper kinds of techniques that will help empower people rather than taking their power away when they work with experts on dreams. But the conference itself is amazing. We're having 200 separate events on everything from clinical use of dreams to lucid dreams, dreams and expressive arts, ways of understanding themes in dreams, research on the biology and psychology of dreams. Researchers from all over the world are going to be there. There's going to be special events. I'm even doing, there's going to be a wine tasting, and I'm doing a hike where we talk about recurring dreams on a hike through a state park near Sonoma State. There's just an amazing array of events and incredible people, famous authors and people who you can meet and study with. And it's kind of an instant community of dream aficionados.
Yes.
People who love dreams. We're all gathered together to share research, to share dreams, to learn about different theories, and it's just really an amazing event.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you there again, and And that this is probably where we should wind it up. So I'm going to say, Dr. Alan Siegel, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Dr. Alan Siegel. In the interview, he made reference to the possibility of precognitive dreams. Now, that's something we've discussed here before, the idea that sometimes a dream will have an element of something in it that has yet to happen. And for myself, I'm a believer, as you probably know. It's just happened to me too many times to not be a believer. And yet, the instances of it happening always seem very small and trivial, and so far I haven't really been able to create a strong link between these precognitive instances and my emotional issues. Now, here's a recent example. Last Friday morning, I woke up from a dream about an event that I would, in actuality, be attending later that same day. And the event that I was going to be attending was a 3-hour seminar on delivering better PowerPoint presentations. So in my dream, I was dreaming about this upcoming event, and I dreamt that the presenter began his presentation by showing us a PowerPoint that began with a very colorful cartoon filled with frolicking cartoon-type animals. And the point of it was that he was showing us that this could be a good technique of beginning with a cartoon that could provide a powerful way of grabbing the audience's interest. Later that morning, after I'm awake and out of bed, I drive down to San Francisco to attend the PowerPoint seminar. I've never seen the presenter before, but he begins with a PowerPoint presentation, and the very first thing to pop up on the screen is the rainbow circle logo from the Looney Tunes cartoons and the theme music to go with it. I'm sure you've seen it. Now, to me, that was a major hit. I really find it hard to chalk it up just to coincidence. Now, if I try to tie it in somehow to my emotional life, I'd have to say that, in fact, this coming fall, I'll be giving presentations at 2 different conferences, and I'll be using PowerPoint, and of course, I'm processing this in the back of my mind quite a bit, and trying to think of ways to make my presentations interesting and compelling. And I'm always afraid of boring people and, you know, have insecurities crop up. So I have to admit that there's some emotional charge there, and maybe that's what drove this psychic hit. What do you think? If you're interested in finding out more about the dream conference we discussed, the dates are June 29 through July 3rd of 2007, and you can get additional information at www.asdreams.org. You are definitely invited.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
I've heard from a number of you that there's been a problem with the last 3 shows showing up as being 495 plus minutes long or 8 hours long. Now, I promise you, I haven't created any 8-hour long shows, at least not yet. And I'm trying to get to the bottom of this problem. This current episode may even suffer from that bug as well. I hope not, but it's not resolved yet, so, you know, I'm not that hopeful. Evidently, this is causing a problem for people listening on an iPod and maybe on other players as well, in terms of being able to pause it, get back to where you were, skip ahead, and so on. Now, my best guess, after trying to troubleshoot this, having spent some time on it and talked to other people, I think the problem is on the pod show server rather than in the file that I've created. I think it might be being caused by that, what they call a pre-roll, that ad about help us suck less, I think may have introduced the problem, although evidently other shows that are using that don't have the problem. So I called them up this morning, and they promised to look into it, but you know, I don't have any control over how long that's going to take, what level of priority they give it. As irritating as this problem is for you, the listener, believe me, it's even more vexing to me because I really want to create a good listening experience for you. So I hope you'll continue to listen, to hang in there with me, you know, we're going to get to the bottom of this. However, this very show may have the same problem. Now, this is show number 94. And again, I'm hoping you'll send me an audio clip I can use for show number 100, which is almost here. And this may be the last reminder here that I'll send someone a copy of the book Warriors, Settlers, and Nomads by Terence Watts for the best audio transition received before the end of this month of May 2007. And we're almost at the end of the month, so I think this is the last time I'll be able to announce this. So for either the 100th show celebration or a transition to enter into that contest, just send me a short voice clip. And as I've mentioned before, you can send me an MP3 file to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, or you can click on the My Chingo logo on our website and record it there. You can leave a voice message for ShrinkPod on Skype, or you can use our phone message line at 206-337-0622. We have no new additions to the Frapper map. Once again, the sponsors for this show are Podshow and GoDaddy, so remember to use the code SHRINK3 at checkout from GoDaddy to get a discount on your next domain name or web hosting purchase.
It's Jeff and Carl Jung saying, you're on the couch with Dr. Dave. Your thoughts on the show, Carl?
I think there will be a reaction. A great change of our psychological attitude is imminent. That is certain.
Right on then. Take it away, Dr. Dave.
I'd really like to get some more of that kind of great creativity. I'm not going to read any emails today. I have received a number of them alerting me to the problem about the incorrect show length and the resulting problems. I really appreciate everyone who contacted me to let me know about this problem because I was blissfully unaware of it until those emails started coming in. Each writer not only let me know about the problem, but also how much they value the show, and that always means a lot to me. So thank you all. You know, it's ironic that this group of shows are all reporting as long when, in fact, they're the shortest ones I've done in recent history. Thanks again to Dr. Alan Siegel for his insights on the wisdom of the dream. Technical problems aside, I hope you're enjoying this series on different approaches to dream work. This is the last show I'll put out before my trip to Hawaii. When I get back, I'll be picking up the thread on dreams again with return guest Dr. Stanley Krippner. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.